This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for coming by this show. We always appreciate you listening. We're going to have another interesting show. As we've been doing lately, we've been following a lot about what's going on with global affairs. Things have been going on in the Middle East, Africa, things have been going on in Mexico and other areas. But if anybody's been monitoring the news lately, you've been seeing some situations that are ever evolving in Syria and Egypt and other areas in the Middle East and Africa that are really heating up and really have some strong implications for U.S. involvement, for what's going to happen in the Middle East as that's an ever-evolving situation. And today we have with us Eric Thompson. He's a vice president of CNA, and they're a think tank that is federally funded for a number of different reasons, and Eric can explain what they do. But he's also the director for the Center of Strategic Studies at CNA, and he's going to talk to us. He's a Middle East expert, has been following these areas and these issues for quite some time, and he understands the Middle East and Africa quite well, and he's going to break down what these situations mean to us in terms of America involvement. Eric, thank you for coming on Fed Access.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you here today.
Hey, I want to talk to you about what CNA does in a few minutes. As a matter of fact, you know what? Tell us about that first so people can understand what CNA is, and then we can start talking about these issues.
Sure. CNA is an independent nonprofit research and analysis organization based in Alexandria, Virginia. And we have experts on a wide range of issues from technical, from economics to policy to regional specialists. And we also spend time working with the military. CNA is a nonprofit organization, but it's home to a federally funded research and development center, the Center for Naval Analyses, which is an analytic organization that supports the Department of Defense and primarily the Navy and the Marine Corps. So I'm looking forward to drawing from my experiences, both working with military, but also as an academic as well. And I'm a part-time adjunct professor at Catholic University here in town as well. So I try to keep a foot in the academic environment. I will be speaking for myself and not for the organization, but I sure am glad that you are engaging CNA, because we do spend a lot of time thinking about these issues and are happy to chat with you about them today.
That's outstanding. I was in the Marine Corps, Eric, and I would see some of your materials. I mean, some CNA's Center for Naval Analysis materials sometime, and look through that. So I kind of knew about what you guys would do. Glad to have you on the show. Hey, talk to us about what you're looking at in terms of Syria. This, you know, chemical situation of possible a chemical attack. You know, some people assume that it may have been Sarin, but no one really completely knows. We're only speculating by saying that. But if this is the case, I mean, what you've seen on either the news or what you've seen from either your reports, is this likely that Syria has engaged now in a chemical attack? And if they have, what is, you know, going to be the consequences of this?
Right. It is soon to be seen, I think, whether the international community is going to conclude that it was decisively an action taken by the Syrian government. But clearly, a lot of indications point to that being the case. And if that is the case, the timing of this alleged chemical attack really boggles the mind. This is a moment in which the international community was very focused on the chemical weapons issue. The United Nations inspection team is on the ground in Syria for the first time, looking into three previous other alleged attacks as well. So international attention is there, and the experts are on the ground to potentially look into these issues. So it sort of boggles the mind as to why the Syrians would think about doing that at this moment. It also reinvigorates the question of what people have been referring to as red lines. We know that President Obama had called the use of chemical weapons a red line earlier, and the earlier allegations led to a conclusion by the U.S. intelligence community that, in fact, chemical weapons had been used by the Syrian government. But through sort of the natural course of diplomacy and some lucky timing by this in Syria for the regime, Those red line discussions seem to have receded into the past. Now those are brought back to the fore, and that question as to whether this is actually a red line for the U.S. or for the international community has been brought to the fore at the very moment where the international community is focused on this.
You know,
it's even more puzzling.
Go ahead.
Because this follows on the heel of a number of fairly decisive victories by Syrian conventional military forces against the rebel forces, and there was a bit of momentum on the Syrian government side and some questioning as to whether any sort of military intervention would be reasonably beneficial given the changing facts on the ground. So the timing of it is really pretty vexing in terms of trying to make sense of why the Syrian regime would do this at this moment.
You know, I had a conversation with somebody yesterday, and we were talking about Syria, and we were talking about as it relates to, you know, Iraq and the whole dynamic of how things were built up about the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and nothing was found. And now we have this new situation where there could possibly be, but now people are skeptical of the intelligence. And also what you kind of brought out about the timing of this seems to kind of be odd, especially, you know, given the facts on the ground that the Syria armed forces were taking some ground back from their opponents and everything else. Are we at a moment where the skepticism of any kind of chemical attack is high, and a lot of our allies or anybody else is really skeptical about, you know, if this is going to be actual factual?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. We're so close to the most recent attack, it's hard to discern from the sort of, you know, day-to-day chatter how much countries have definitively become skeptics of this. But there has been a lot of international interest, and it has been UN Security Council endorsed teams going in to inspect from the previous allegations. So there does seem to be some international concern. What is, I think, also interesting is you made a passing reference to Iraq, is that I would argue that, you know, the allegations of a chemical attack in Syria this week may not serve as an immediate trigger for international military intervention, but it might put Syria on a path that will create opportunities for the international community to later take decisive action. They may, in fact, be paving a path for international action. When we think back to the experience of Iraq, it was not the confirmation of the presence or use of weapons of mass destruction that drove international activity and drove the establishment of a coalition that actually engaged in Operation Iraqi Freedom. It was the lack of cooperation from the Iraqi regime. It was the deceptive tactics. It was the browbeating and abuse of the UN inspectors on the ground that really made the international community become fed up and become much, much more open to the idea of collective military action on Iraq. So this may or may not be a trigger event. It may or may not signal decisive, you know, points for other countries, but it may have put Syria on a path where international action, military action, or very other forms of strong action may be the end result of this particular event.
You know, as people think about this and as we're monitoring, you know, these different issues and why this is important, I always want to kind of let people understand, especially in the Middle East, you know, why certain countries are important in terms of us. You know, Syria is definitely one of those countries that's, you know, off the water and other things like that. But for you, I mean, as you look at it in international issues and look at the Middle East, why is Syria important as it relates to the United States and our allies? Why do we need to be concerned about this?
Sure. When we tend to think about strategic implications of the potential conflict, we think about, great power or outside influence. We think about the dynamics of the Security Council. But the strategic implications of conflict in Syria are really borne out at the regional level. And they're important and they're worthwhile to consider as we're looking at policy options. You know, an unstable, a divided, a violent, an ungoverned Syria has the potential to have spillover effect into other countries, whether that's foreign fighters coming across, whether that's ethnic or sectarian groups being energized across borders. And we've seen that in other countries where you lose central control, whether that's Libya, whether that's Iraq for a period of time, or Afghanistan. But really, in terms of the U.S. interests, there are a couple of key countries that our security interests are closely tied with. It could be negatively affected by the conflict in Syria and by the continuation or expansion of that conflict. First amongst those is arguably Jordan. Jordan is one of the U.S. Government's closest partners in the region. It has been unswerving in its partnership with the U.S. despite the perturbations of the Arab Spring and a variety of other things that are going on in the region. And the U.S. has committed heavily to that partnership and in fact, has provided military support to the Jordanians in preparing them to defend themselves from any nefarious things that come across the border. Obviously, the collapse of the Syrian regime and the emergence of extremist organizations that have access to weapons and funding is of great concern to another important security partner of the U.S., and that's Israel. And so as this Syrian conflict mutates over time, as new players come to the fore, as new weapons are used, and decisive battles take place, the Israeli strategic calculus inherently changes, and that has an impact for us. There's also an impact for the U.S. when we look at it in terms of those that have are on the side of the Syrians, primarily Hezbollah and Iran. And how Syria unfolds will either be an opportunity to embolden Iran and Hezbollah in a sort of expansionist web of activity outside their own borders, or it may actually undermine and enfeeble their efforts to pose a military threat or military or try to impose a military solution outside their borders. So those have big strategic implications for us. And finally is Turkey. Turkey itself has been very concerned about the violence in Syria, has been looking for international action, has been using its role in NATO to drive some response from NATO countries, which included sending U.S. Patriot missiles to Turkey. But on the other hand, the Turks are very concerned with outcomes that might negatively affect their interests. And so they are going to be actively trying to shape this conflict, whether or not there's collective international activity. And Turkey being an important strategic partner of the U.S. and an important partner in our relationships with other parts of the Middle East and Central Asia really does have strategic implications. So it stacks up as sort of a wall of strategic bricks for us as it affects our most important partners in the region.
We're going to take a quick break. I want to continue this conversation when we come back, because this is interesting in terms of implications. You mentioned a number of different countries who are allies, Turkey, Israel, and others, and another strategic implications of what this means, whether it be Hezbollah, terrorist organizations, Iran, and everything else. And so it has a number of different implications and consequences if this thing continues to go on. We're talking to Eric Thompson. He's one of the vice presidents at CNA, their strategic think tank. You can find them at CNA.org. He's also the director of their Center for Strategic Studies. And we are talking about what's going on in the Middle East. We're talking about what's going on in Egypt. We're talking about a number of strategic issues that have a very, very big implications to the United States and what's going to happen with our foreign policy, our national security policy, and many, many other things. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we are talking about a number of different issues that you are seeing in the news right now. What's going on in Syria in terms of a chemical attack? What's going on in Egypt in terms of the government and just a complete change in the government, the brotherhood and everything else that's going on? These are a number of different issues that are really, really big in the news, but they also have a number of different consequences and implications for the United States. We're talking to Eric Thompson. He's the vice president at CNA. You can find them at CNA.org. They're a think tank, a research organization, driving a number of different ideas and putting out a number of different ideas as it relates to national security, foreign policy, and other important issues. He's also the director of their Center for Strategic Studies, and he's talking to us about these issues today. Eric, you know, we were talking about Syria. It seems as if this conflict is going to be ongoing. If it is a chemical attack, and President Obama talked about this red line, and you were talking about it earlier, about, you know, have they passed this red line? If the red line actually is confirmed by the United Nations that, hey, this has been passed, do you think we will go into any kind of military? I doubt if we would do boots on the ground, but what do you think would end up happening? Are we going to use air power? Are we going to continue to try to use maybe covert action and fund, you know, put more weapons on the ground and fund certain things? What do you think is next if the red line has been crossed?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, it would be pure speculation to predict what we're going to do, but I'll give you some of my thoughts on what may happen, what we may be considering. One is, there is no doubt in, I think, my mind, and I think there's little doubt in the minds of other people inside and outside government looking at the Syrian situation, that it really is vexing for us, primarily because the Syrian opposition itself isn't coherent isn't unified and includes some really unsavory groups and people undertaking some very unsavory actions. And that makes it very difficult to imagine a clear and peaceful consolidation of a post-Assad Syrian regime. And so as we start thinking about how one might apply military force to this particular problem, you quickly get to the question of, well, what kind of outcome are you hoping to generate? There was a letter that General Dempsey had written to Congressman Engel that made it into the press in the last couple of days, where he laid out his thinking, and that essentially gave the congressman the idea that the military is willing and able to take military activity in Syria, will change the military balance on the ground, but won't create solutions to some of these enduring and deep historic, ethnic, sectarian, cultural, and political issues in Syria. So my thinking is, if that point of view is influential, and I think it's, I would find it pretty convincing, it's, there's no clear path for the White House to say decisively, right now, military action will create the kind of outcome we're looking for. It's going to take a lot more effort diplomatically. It's going to take some political risk to choose winners and losers amongst the opposition who we want to support. And so I don't see necessarily immediate decisive action coming from a single decision in the White House. I think a lot of work will have to be done because I think the military is pretty clear that they can generate some effects on the ground, but the long-term solution that comes after that is still difficult for us to define, and even more difficult for us to actually make happen because of the divisive nature of the Syrian opposition.
And I'm assuming that, you know, we don't necessarily want to get tied up. I mean, especially as we're now withdrawing from, you know, we're out of Iraq, so to say, and now we're, you know, we're trying to get out of Afghanistan, or at least draw back combat operations in Afghanistan. The country's probably very, very gun shy right now to really get involved heavily in any kind of military action that would involve anything major, would you say?
I think that's probably the sentiment in the United States. I think there is a degree of war weariness, or at least a reluctance to get involved in other wars until we decisively and definitively need to get involved and understand what our role is going to be. I think when you look at it in terms of the policy community, I think there are lessons to be learned from the Libya operation, where the U.S. recognizes and understands it can, and in many times should, play a decisive role in being the center of gravity in a coalition and a collective effort when military action seems warranted, but is less, or at least in that circumstance, was not interested in putting boots on the ground or creating particular outcomes politically or in the security environment, other than changing decisively the military balance at the time, which was, of course, Muammar Gaddafi's attacks on his own people. So I think there's no great appetite for it. But given the strategic issues that I alluded to earlier, there are compelling reasons for the United States to pay attention and to potentially become involved if we can really come to a solution collectively that will produce outcomes that will be beneficial to the Syrian people and will be beneficial to the security situation of some of our key partners in the region.
I know we're speculating right here, Eric, but what the ideal kind of utopian situation, as we, you know, look at our involvement, as we look at who we are, you know, who we picked our sides with, who we're now starting to fund and put resources in, are we looking to possibly create a democratic Syria, a country that now has would that be the end goal of to create a country that has a democratic-run government and now can be an ally, which has not been an ally for us for however long?
Yeah, as I read the policy statements coming out of the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government, it is clear that we would like to see a peaceful, democratic Syria that integrates the various ethnic and sectarian minorities, that doesn't use violence against its own people, that sees a transition from the Assad regime to something else and something that's much, much more representative of the Syrian people. But as we've learned in Iraq and as we've learned in Afghanistan, as the Arab Spring has shown us, there is no clear consensus in many of these societies as to exactly what form of governance they think is best for them. And so I think we can think about what would be best from the U.S. perspective, but I think we've learned over the last decade that having a good idea here does not necessarily create the kind of outcomes that will be palatable, acceptable, sustainable, or beneficial to the people on the ground. So I think we're a little more circumspect now than we have been in the past, given that experience.
You know, as we kind of, and I want to start to shift to Egypt, but as we look at this situation, I mean, it for me and what we're talking about and from what you're saying, this is kind of, this looks like a more of a long-term scenario. I mean, it looks like this is not going to be, even like Libya. I mean, Libya, you know, it lasted for more months, but this almost seems as if, and it feels as if this is going to be a lot longer to deal with. I mean, the country has, a changing dynamic. Two very, very split sides that have very, very strong holds on the country, and this doesn't seem like it's going to be over anytime soon.
I would think that is absolutely the case. Even were Assad to disappear tonight, the long term consolidation of what comes next isn't very promising and doesn't come very quickly. So I think we're looking at years and years and years before we have a new Syria of whatever flavor it ultimately will be.
Do you think are we at a point? Of course, there's certain things, but has the country basically isolated in terms of economics? I mean, are there any kind of economic solutions, how sanctions are put in place? I mean, has the country been isolated to that point right now where that may work?
The Syrian government has been under, formal and informal sanctions for a lengthy period of time. Syria was not a highly globalized society or globalized economy before the conflict started. They had very limited trade with their neighbors. They had very limited imports of Western technology that they had. They produced a little oil, burned most of it themselves, had a relationship with the Russians where the Russians really supplied a lot of materials at low cost or on very, very favorable financial terms. And so it wasn't really a robust trading relationship. That was more of a partnership that benefited both countries politically, but didn't really have a sort of a strong economic link behind it that could be influenced by international actions. And so there isn't much more that the international community can do to try to change Assad's thinking when it comes to economic sanctions or denying them economic opportunities. They've been denied those for the last year and a half or 2 years and have continued to carry on this fight in spite of that.
We got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to start shifting to Egypt, Eric, and we want to talk about what's going on with this ever-evolving situation. Some definite new changes of the government. The Muslim Brotherhood have been ousted out of power by the military. There's some changes. Mubarak may be back in the picture in some form or fashion. There's a number of different things that Egypt has going on, and Egypt has always been considered, to a degree, an ally of the United States, and we want to talk about what these changes have, what are the consequences of these changes for us and also for the entire region. We're talking to Eric Thompson. He is one of the vice presidents at CNA. They're a think tank. You can find them at CNA.org. They deal with a number of strategic, national security, foreign policy, international issues, everything from naval situations, maritime, to the Middle East, and a number of different range of issues. But you can find them on CNA.org. They've got some interesting materials on there. Eric is also the director of the Center for Strategic Studies there, and you can find that at the CNA.org. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the Middle East. We'll talk more about Egypt. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we've been having a very, very interesting conversation. If you did not listen to the first couple segments, please go back into the archive and listen to them. But we've been having a very, very interesting discussion about what's going on with the Syria situation, the possible use of chemical weapons. We'll find that out soon if this has taken place. The number of implications that Syria has in terms of this conflict, the desire for America to possibly have a democratic Syrian government. But this is all seems very, very long term and nothing that's going to happen in the immediate future. We want to kind of shift our gears towards Egypt right now. We're talking to Eric Thompson. He's one of the vice presidents at CNA, which is a strategic think tank. And you can find them at CNA.org. But he's also the director of their Center for Strategic Studies and subject matter expert on the Middle East and Africa and things that are going on in that region. But we've got this situation in Egypt, Eric. this thing is seem to be spiraling out of control more and more every day. The counts of people who have been killed seems to grow on a daily basis. Recent reports about Mubarak possibly being flown back into certain parts of the country. The Muslim Brotherhood seems to be fighting a fight against the military. What are you seeing that's going on in Egypt, and what's the consequence? Where is this thing going to be going?
Well, it's a fascinating time in Egypt right now, and there's a whole lot of things going on that we can talk about. I would say to start, the removal of Mohamed Morsi as the president of Egypt really changed the game in a way that made it difficult for other countries, the U.S. included, to come up with a simple and straightforward response that had a clear logic to it. It was a development that was vexing to the monarchies of the Arabian Gulf, for example, countries that had been supportive of the idea of Mubarak staying in power initially. Some of them, like Qatar, had been somewhat energized by the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood coming in and taking power. The Saudis, for example, were not unhappy, but find themselves in a situation where they become one of the few friends that Cairo now has to turn to for funding and things of that nature. So it puts them in a center position in this discussion and debate that they weren't necessarily anticipating. For the Western democracies, it sort of flummoxed several capitals in Paris and London and to a degree Washington, where all those countries had been initially supportive of the idea of a democratic Egypt emerging in a post-Mubarak era, some harboring some concerns about the true intentions and goals of the Muslim Brotherhood, but taking a wait-and-see look. And then seeing sort of a reset button being pushed by the actions of the Egyptian military gave us sort of a moment to say, hey, is this beneficial or not? And the answer is not clear and simple. We have a complex relationship with Egypt. It's a strategic partnership. It's a major non-NATO ally, lots of military aid and assistance, lots of economic and development assistance as well. And so we're finding ourselves questioning, where do we stand on this issue? What decisions are we going to take, and what are the potential implications for the Egyptians on the ground? And it's a messy situation right now, and it's very difficult for us and for other countries to come to a definitive and rapid conclusion as to whether this is good or bad or dangerous or not for Egypt and the Egyptian people.
You know, as we look at it, you know, Egypt in terms of, and there's a number of strategic issues. And I'm kind of, Eric, and you provided a great understanding of Syria and why it is important. I want to give that same kind of dynamic for Egypt and people understanding, whether it be the Suez Canal or a number of different issues. Why is Egypt important in a strategic nature for the United States and also the global community? Why is this country, you know, why are we monitoring this so much? And why is the change of power? And what's happening in this country right now, why is it important for all of us to understand?
Sure. Well, Egypt is important strategically to the United States for several reasons. It has been a long-time partner of the U.S. in the Arab world, has worked closely with the U.S. military, has been a partner in many diplomatic initiatives. Probably the earliest and greatest culmination of that was the signing of the Camp David Accords and being the first country to actually sign a peace agreement with Israel. Egypt also is a cultural and political and informational center of gravity within the Arab world. The Egyptian media is very influential across the rest of the world. The Egyptian cultural television, those sorts of things are influential. And to have a good relationship with Egypt, to understand that culture, to interact with them, to have them cooperate with U.S. production agencies and those sorts of things can be very beneficial. Obviously, the Suez Canal is a strategic asset to Egypt. It's important to us. A lot of U.S. commerce goes through, and lots of U.S. Navy vessels go through there on their way to and from the Arabian Gulf and North Arabian Sea. And the prospects of that, the security of the canal being at risk, is of immediate strategic concern to us. More broadly, there are several other countries that are concerned about where Egypt goes, not the least of those being Israel. Israel had the benefit for a generation of having a peaceful border with Egypt and was able to concentrate its security focus on other borders, for example, Lebanon, and was able to have enough political space to eventually negotiate a peace agreement with Jordan as well. Now, for the first time in a generation, the Sinai Peninsula is not, in fact, a Egyptian-controlled zone of security and stability. It is a partially ungoverned space with a wide degree of lawlessness. There was a major attack against Egyptian security forces that killed a couple of dozen last week. And that does not give Israel that secure flank that it has had for a generation. So while it faces the dilemma of what's going on in Syria, while it faces an invigorated Hezbollah, it also has to be concerned about new threats on its western border. On the other hand, though, the Morsi government seemed to express sentiments that also caused Israel to have pause and to consider what its long-term security future was. So you may find those in Israel that say the change of government and the emergence of the military government may bring promise of restabilizing that relationship and restabilizing that border. But either way, that has an important security and strategic implication for the United States. There is also the question facing many other governments in the Middle East that are struggling with their own democratic movements, whether it's Algeria, whether it's Tunisia, whether it's Bahrain, whether it's Iraq or Syria, that what are the potential paths that may come out of the mobilization of your people? And I think there are lots of countries in the region that are watching Egypt closely to understand what those dynamics are like and what ability sitting governments actually have to influence those events and keep themselves in power.
You know, Eric, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, you know, I think what we need to talk about is why now are the people, you know, going into the streets and now saying, you know what, we are demanding change, and we didn't like Mubarak, we didn't like the Muslim Brotherhood, we don't like the military. Some people need to understand what is being asked for by the people. What are the different groups in this country asking for? We know that now the strategic implications, and we know the strategic value of Egypt, especially with the Suez Canals and a number of other different things you just mentioned, that lends to how we get our oil resources, a number of other different other imports and exports that go in and out of that country, our naval resources. But I want to talk about that when we come back. We got to take a quick break. We're talking to Eric Thompson. He's one of the vice presidents at CNA. It's a think tank, a nonprofit organization. They have under them the Center for Naval Analysis. They also have a Center for Strategic Studies that Eric is director of, but they focus in on foreign policy, national security, doing research and analysis on a number of these different issues, providing some great input and thoughts and analysis for the military and other organizations. We're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about Africa. We're talking about Egypt. We're talking about all the strategic issues that are going on in that region right now, but we'll be right back after this break. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. George on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been having a very, very interesting conversation focused mainly on Syria and mainly on Egypt. Two things that are very much so in the news. If you've been looking at any news program recently, you have seen these things. But these are very, very important issues internationally that we need to know about and need to understand and need to, you know, monitor. Because, you know, the United States is involved in it, whether it be economically, our military may be involved. A number of different issues, but the global community is also involved, and what happens in some of these countries also will impact us in a number of different ways. We're talking to Eric Thompson. He is one of the vice presidents at an organization called CNA. They're a think tank, and you can find them at cna.org, but they do a research and analysis on national security, international affairs, foreign policy issues. He also is the director of the Center for Strategic Studies at CNA, and so you can find all of their work at cna.org. Eric, you know, we were talking about Egypt. As we look at the different parties, because this has been a very, very rapidly changing situation in terms of leadership of the country, Mubarak, the Muslim Brotherhood, the military, kind of going on and on and on. Now the people are in the streets. What are the people, or what are these different forces? What are they asking for? What are they looking for in terms of government? We talked about democratic elections in that country. Is that what's being sought after? I mean, what is going on? Why is this happening?
Sure. There are several different groups in Egypt that are trying to express their, you know, their aspirations through public protests and getting involved in the political process. And sometimes several of these groups, their interests will overlap and sometimes they will diverge. So let me just spend a moment and talk to you about some of the important groups to keep in mind. One is there is a what many people call a youth movement in Egypt, and that is inspired by the Arab Spring revolutions in other countries in North Africa in particular, and that is people who would like to see their countries become more open, more democratic, become more attached and interactive with the international community, have more personal freedom of expression, access to information, and to sort of socially organize themselves into effective political activity that changes the world that they live in ways that they find beneficial. There is an Islamist movement within Egypt that has two characters to it that is worthwhile to keep in mind. There is the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamist organization that was established in the 1920s in Egypt, and their goal was to promote the broader, gradual Islamization of society, to make Islam the defining characteristic of Egyptian society. And that meant in schools, and that meant in social programs and social development, but it also meant in politics as well. There are also Islamists in Egypt that are they're quite strident in their views and want to have an Islamic government and potentially the establishment of a caliphate, that are willing to use violence, that are violently opposed to the existence of the State of Israel and the peace accord of Camp David. So those are a couple of flavors of the Islamists. There's also the business class within Egypt. These are people that have either benefited from or taken advantage of the opportunities provided under the Mubarak administration to build up small companies, to tie into international companies and open affiliates in Egypt, to develop domestic industries. And the last class or group of people is the military and security forces themselves, which were a large apparatus of the state under Mubarak, but also had a wide degree of public support and national support as they represented the government of Egypt, but also had a good deal of power independent of the president, as we saw in the last days of Mubarak and as we've seen recently with the reemergence of the military government. So there are several, and there are other centers of gravity as well, but those are important players. And so initially, most of those groups lined up against Mubarak and were willing to roll out into the streets of Tahrir Square to bring the fall of the Mubarak government and to participate, most of them, in the elections that brought Morsi to bear. However, the Morsi government itself pursued an agenda that wasn't necessarily inclusive of all of those interests. Or if they tried to be inclusive, they did it in a somewhat ungainly and ineffective manner. And so you had progressively over time skepticism and then leading to dislocation and really anger at the Morsi government. And that manifested itself by a few of these groups coming together and demanding his ouster. Now, throughout this process, the security forces in Egypt maintained their own internal coherence and cogency. They maintained order within the ranks. And they maintained a political vision to make sure that Egypt remained unified and that they were going to have a definitive role in charting the future of Egypt. So it's this kind of dynamic as these players have shuffled for position. Now, they're all looking for a better Egypt. They would all like to see economic development. They would like to see Egypt have a more influential role in the region and internationally. But they have different ideas on how you actually achieve that.
You know, as we look at the ever-evolving, and you kind of broke this down greatly in terms of the different people, the different parties who have an interest in the country, and rightfully so. But is all this evolving? I mean, is it social media? I mean, was this a kind of a something that was always ready to pop, and it was just kind of a bursting point that was at some point in time was going to happen regardless? Or is it now that social media, and as you mentioned about other countries who are now following what's happening in Egypt in terms of, like you mentioned, Bahrain and other countries who have always had either autocratic or dictator type environment or monarchies or whatever the case is, but now they're seeing people who are coming out in the streets and demanding change. Is this because people are seeing it happen in other countries, you know, because of social media, or what's the evolving factor in this?
I think initially when we saw the revolution that brought the end of the Mubarak regime, you know, social media played a large role. The access to information and the inspiration from other countries surely drove and energized the Egyptian populist political movement that brought the downfall of the Mubarak government. But since then, I think the sort of most important driver of continued political turmoil is the knowledge that was developed that the Egyptians could actually empower themselves and could change the outcome of their political circumstance through demonstrations, through making demands, through forming political organizations. And it's, I think, while social media and sort of the access to information continues to be an important element of this, I think it's really the realization amongst the Egyptians that they can actually change facts on the ground. They can undo political circumstances through will and concerted effort. And lots of these different groups understand that and have different agendas they'd like to pursue through that and have different means and capabilities to actually create that change. So it's that that realization that they actually have political power now. They can apply it. The question is, will they be able to find a resolution and an integration of this, these aspirations and these powers to create a central government that is functional, that actually brings forth those common aspirations of economic development and self-determination and influence in the region and that sort of reinvigoration of Egyptianness.
You know, we only got about a minute left, but as we look at Egypt and as we look at the consequences, you know, the military has kind of really taken the populist role of maybe kind of supporting the protesters almost when the mass populace, you know, seemed to want to change, the military kind of helped to foster this change. Is the military going to continue to stay with that role or where do you see them? They seem to be the controlling hand in this.
The military has definitely been interested, actively engaged in the political process since before the Mubarak Revolution. There's no doubt about that. But one thing that I see different now is that, you know, the Egyptian military appears not just to be following the sentiments of the people, but has its own idea about what the shortest and most direct path to a positive outcome, from their perspective, is for Egypt. And their willingness to use violence and to engage in wide-scale arrests, particularly Muslim Brotherhood members, I think signals to me a deeper commitment not to compromise further and to try to make sure Egypt gets on a path that they think is going to be best for the country. Now, there's going to be a lot of debate as to whether that is the case or not, but I don't think the Egyptian military is now keeping for itself the role of an impartial actor or following the sentiments and the will of the people. I think they've made some definitive choices to make sure that a particular kind of outcome emerges. I don't know whether it'll be successful, but I don't think they are bouncing around from one perspective or being willing to apply themselves wherever they think popular sentiments are. I think a different kind of decision has been made, and I think they're trying to drive a particular kind of outcome that they think is best for Egypt, and it is unclear whether the rest of the Egyptians feel that way as well.
Eric Thompson, he is one of the vice presidents at CNA, a strategic think tank. You can find them at CNA.org. They've got some great materials on there, definitely some must reads. He's also the director of their Center for Strategic Studies. Eric, we definitely probably want to have you back, you know, as we continue to monitor this situation. Thank you so much for providing the insight that you have today. I think it's very good for people to hear. As we see what's going on, we definitely want to talk to you again.
Well, it was my pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, Friday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.